WNYC Studios is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Protein degradation can target and destroy cancer-causing proteins right inside the cell. It's how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at DanaFarber.org/everywhere.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Happy New Year, everybody. Hope you got a nice long break with Christmas and New Year's coming on Tuesdays. That meant two very long weekends or one very long vacation for a lot of folks. And if you're back to your regular stuff today, hope you enjoyed whatever it was. It is day one of the post-fiscal cliff world, and it is day one of the new fiscal cliff world. March 1st, spending cuts and debt ceiling deadline. Here we come. New York Times columnist David Brooks is our first guest today with some thoughts on what Congress and the president have wrought and what they have yet to write, and also on some bigger picture items. David gives out his Sidney Awards each December for the best essays of the year. He also edited the 2012 Best American Essays book, and he's about to teach a course in humility at Yale. We'll touch on all those things. Happy New Year, David. Thanks for doing this. Welcome back to WNYC.
Great to be with you again.
Your column on the fiscal cliff deal this week before the final vote, but I think about the same provisions of it, is about how it raises $600 billion with the tax hikes, but doesn't really deal with the deficit. What's the big picture right now as you see it?
Well, the reason we had a fiscal cliff was we were trying to get a hold on our debt problem, and the president wanted a balance of tax hikes and spending cuts, and that seemed like a reasonable thing, and the voters more or less endorsed that. But we ended up getting a deal which does practically nothing to control the debt. It does have $600 billion in new taxes over 10 years, but we're going to accrue about $8 trillion in new debt over that time, and it's completely unbalanced. We have some tax increases, absolutely no spending cuts. And so, you know, I actually sympathize with Michael Bennett, who Senator Michael Bennett for Colorado, who Maureen wrote about today, and even Marco Rubio from Florida, the people who voted against it. I'm not sure I would have had the guts to vote against it, but I consider it pretty much a failure.
But next comes the new fiscal cliff. I guess it's March 1st, unless the debt ceiling forces it a little bit earlier than that, where they'll do part two, which presumably is the spending cuts. Now, here's President Obama last night with a 2013 wish about that.
I will not have another debate with this Congress over whether or not they should pay the bills that they have already racked up through the laws that they passed. The one thing that I think hopefully in the new year we'll focus on is seeing if we can put a package like this together with a little bit less drama, a little less brinksmanship, not scare the heck out of folks quite as much.
So, David, I guess I have a two-part question on that. One, is it likely to be less contentious with less drama, less brinksmanship? And is this the second half of a two-part dance to a place that is meaningful in terms of the debt?
Well, answer one is easy. No, it's going to be the same. We're now in an era of budget showdowns. We've been in it for about 2 years. I was hoping we could do something big this time and get out of that era and then actually talk about immigration and gun control and all the other stuff we should be talking about. But we're basically stuck in an era of budget showdowns, not only the reconciliation, then debt ceiling, then the budget process, and then something called the continuing resolution. It's going to go on forever.
But is it because the sequestration budget, so-called, at the last debt ceiling, you know, debacle, was supposed to force these big deficit-affecting cuts automatically unless Congress came in with its own version. And now they put that off for 2 months, but just 2 months. So does this not give us a prospect of ending, you know, the budget showdown era because they're really going to be forced to deal with it this time?
No, why should next time be any different than this time? Can you imagine trying to plan a budget if you're working in a government agency and you got 2 months and everything's going to blow up again? It's insanity. And then the second thing to be said is the essential problem is the American people will punish anybody who cuts their benefits. And so Republicans talk a lot about, controlling the deficits, controlling the debt. but they don't actually have the courage to suggest any specific things to control spending, and that's what we saw the last couple of weeks. And so they actually propose nothing. They have no strategy. They're completely disarmed. Seems to me the Democrats' problem is, you know, they want to continue a lot of the programs that we have, the Social Security and the Medicare, but these things are unsustainable. And if they want to preserve them, somehow it seems to me they have to find a way to reform them. And the second problem the Democrats have is, you know, since we are running up these huge deficits, essentially you're going to need more revenue. And this was the moment, if you want to preserve these programs, and if you want to do new stuff, you know, new Head Start, new early childhood education, stuff like that, this was the moment when the Democrats had the most possible leverage to get more revenue. Republicans are in complete disarray. They've just lost a big election. This was the moment. And even at this crucial moment, the Democrats could only get $600 billion over 10 years. They couldn't even get tax increases on people earning under $400,000, by and large. And so that is a pretty paltry revenue increase. It's about just over a third of what Obama asked for. It's less than Boehner even offered. And so that this is essentially the problem for liberalism. Where are you going to get the money if you couldn't get it now?
You know, I saw the movie Lincoln on New Year's Eve, and I was thinking how the abolition of slavery was truly worth all the brinksmanship and political hardball portrayed there. All this Sturm und Drang we've just gone through over 4 points one way or the other on the top tax rate for so few Americans. From either side, have we come to life and death rhetoric over any little disagreement? Or to, you know, argue against the point I just made, maybe it's worth celebrating that at least one big intractable issue seems to have gotten resolved through compromise and is now over after 10 years of debate, and that is how much to make permanent the temporary Bush tax cuts.
Well, you know, I just don't think that's worth celebrating. I mean, I opposed all the Bush tax cuts originally, and I would like to see them all repealed gradually after the economy recovers. I just don't think, you know, if we're going to make this sustainable, I quoted some statistics in my last column of what's going to happen. Our deficits, our debt, public debt, is now about 72% of GDP. Within 10 years, it goes up to 90% of GDP. That's the point when you really begin to hammer growth. If you're, say, 25 years old now, according to the IMF, to live up to the obligations that we've made to you if you're 25, we are going to have to immediately and permanently increase all your taxes by 35% and cut all your benefits by 35%. So we're really screwing the next generations. So I think we just have to get more revenue, and we have to have more spending cuts. And I'd say this deal makes getting more revenue much harder, because apparently we're not going to touch anybody making less than $450,000. And the spending cuts don't exist. So, you know, I'm glum. Welcome to my beginning of 2013.
David Brooks, the glum David Brooks, my first guest of 2013 here on WNYC. We'll talk more about the fiscal cliff that just ended and the fiscal cliff to come, and also the Sandy relief bill, as we expect Congressman Gerald Nadler and Congressman Michael Grimm, both from New York City, coming up in our next segment. But I want to move on with David to the Sidney Awards, his December column citing important essays of the year and the book Best American Essays 2012, which David edited. And David, one pairing that caught my eye was the two takes on mental illness that you chose, one for the Sidneys and one in the book. The Tanya Marie Lerman article in the Wilson Quarterly and Marcia Angel in the New York Review of Books both suggest we're getting treatment wrong in the West. And the Angel article, which has stats, is a devastating critique of the lack of science demonstrating the effectiveness of antidepressant medications. Did something tie these two together for you? Is there a big idea behind both?
I guess just fertility. You know, when I look for these essays, first let me say I think we're in a golden age of nonfiction. It's weird, we're in the web, we're in the world of Twitter. But if you go on websites like The Browser or Arts and Letters Daily or longform.org, they link to just great essays. And when I selected the book, when I selected the Sidneys, I'm really struck by how many really great long-form essays are. So the death of letters is not coming. And so what you're looking for is areas of hotness, areas of controversy. And I would say, you know, cognition and mental illness is an area where we're learning a lot. It's the ultimate problem. And I would say the fear of mental health, the sphere of psychology, has been, I guess, in more or less permanent crisis, maybe since Freud, where a lot of things are tried, a lot of ideas seem really good. But the idea, the effectiveness of what we do is just not forthcoming. One essay I want to mention, which is actually forthcoming in the Atlantic Monthly, mm-hmm. is about anesthesia. And one of the things I did not know is a lot of people who go under anesthesia during surgery, they more or less sort of wake up in the middle of the surgery, and they can't move, they can't outwardly react, but they suffer excruciating pain because they're basically aware.
I know somebody that happened to.
And so this is a forthcoming essay on this problem and how do you solve it. And they thought they had a machine to test so we would know when somebody is suddenly aware in the middle of surgery, you could up their dosage. But this machine is broken, or it doesn't work as effectively as we once thought. Hmm. And so the complexities of the human mind are such that mental illness is, you know, the ultimate problem. And so we keep trying things, and often they don't work.
Do you want to mention anything specific that you pointed to in the Lerman article about how they seem to treat schizophrenia with more success in India than they do here?
Yeah, well, this is why it's so hard. It's so complicated. We think of it, and she goes through and describes how do we think about this. They used to think of it as sort of it was a problem of your parents, and this was the awful days, and this applied to autism too, where it was because you had allegedly a refrigerator mom.
Mm-hmm.
Your parents mistreated you, and therefore you had some sort of mental problem. This, of course, is completely untrue. But then we went through the age where we thought, oh, it's a brain problem. It's a physical problem. Your wiring is messed up. Your chemicals are messed up. But it turns out there are such big cultural differences between different areas that can't strictly be true either. And so with a lot of problems, what we're discovering, it's an incredibly complex mixture of genes, social environment, cultural environment. It's just a zillion things all feeding together. And the oddity of the Indian experience is that they have a lot better treatment regimes with a lot of these mental diseases, but they don't do it straightforwardly. One of the things they do is they tell the patients, you know, you're not really sick, but I'd like to give you a pill that'll just give you a little more strength. And this actually turns out to be something to treat a mental illness. And this deception seems to work really well.
Hmm.
The other thing that's happening in India is they just have denser social networks and they're a less individualistic society. And I wouldn't be surprised if that's at the key to a lot of this.
You also gave a Sydney Award, and this kind of goes back to politics, to Walter Russell Mead's article in The American Interest on the two conflicting views of liberalism that he sees defining our politics today, though he argues both are obsolete. Can you describe the two forms of liberalism in a nutshell?
Yeah, I generally try not to get them to politics because I think we overcover politics in the media. But this was such a big think, I made an exception. And so he says the Republicans have what he calls an 1860s brand of Manchesterian liberalism, which is a very libertarian British Victorian version of liberalism from the 19th century, which is, you know, the basic libertarian thing we know from the Republican Party. And that's obsolete. The Democrats have a 20th century New Deal version of liberalism, which for fiscal unsustainability reasons are obsolete. And he says the problem with the Republicans is they reject the Democrat liberalism, but they want to go back to something even more ancient. And so his argument is both these things are obsolete. He does a very good job of tearing down both models. He doesn't really have an answer of where we go from here, but nonetheless, it's such an ambitious essay and so filled with big thoughts, I thought it worth celebrating.
Do you see any third way, or call it what you will, of where we might go from here with some success?
Well, you know, I'm a Hamiltonian, so I believe limited but energetic government to enhance social mobility. And to me, that would involve taking a lot from column A and column B. So from the Democrats, I'd take a lot of early childhood education, a lot of government programs to improve social mobility, like Pell Grants, community colleges, all that stuff. From the Republicans, I'd probably take a bit of their deregulatory regime. And I do think Paul Ryan is at least pointing in the right direction of how to reform entitlements. So I don't have a new philosophy. I think I just merged some of the two approaches we have in front of us mm-hmm. in a different way.
I'm curious, by the way, about your essay reading list. Do you have a list of academic journals or some kind of digest of them that you scan in addition to the popular press to keep up with social science, as you like to do?
Well, I on National Affairs, I get an email list, which is a good conservative magazine. There's an email that goes out every morning with different social science experiments. So every day I get about 10 or 11, the abstracts of them. So I keep up that way. And then a lot of it, if you follow Twitter, if you follow the right academics on Twitter, and if you follow the blogs, you they highlight them, and they begin having debates right now from Wired magazine. There's a great debate that started that Paul Krugman, my colleague, is involved with on the rise of machines and the rise of smart technologies and the way smart technologies are really becoming robots in the information age workplace and how we're really going to integrate much more closely, even if we're journalists, with robots and machines than we ever have before, and they may start to replace us, God forbid.
David Brooks, the irreplaceable, my guest on WNYC, as we talk about the fiscal cliff, but also his Sydney Awards for the best essays of 2012 and the best American essays 2012 book, which he edited this year. And I want to go on to one of your other projects, Humility. No humility seems to be prevalent in politics these days. Are you going to teach a course on humility at Yale in the context of politics and democracy?
A little. You know, the course is designed, everyone makes fun of me, what do you know about humility? You go on the radio and spout off. But, you know, the idea is there are sort of two schools of human nature. There's one school that thinks we're pretty wonderful and society is pretty rotten, and if we just got back to our basic goodness, that would be a nice thing, and that's Jean-Jacques Rousseau. But then there's another school, which I'm a part of, which thinks our inner natures are pretty self-regarding, pretty narcissistic, kind of selfish, and therefore you have to have a strategy to combat your own weaknesses. And so I'm really going to teach a lot of the texts and a lot of the great thinkers who fall into this school. And that would include people going back as far as Augustine, but it would also include Edmund Burke and then some contemporary figures who have become heroes of mine as I've begun to research into this. And they include everybody from Dorothy Day, the great Catholic social worker, to Francis Perkins, who was the Secretary of Labor, to George Marshall. These were all people who really worked in the public sphere. They were ambitious, but they were extremely aware of their own limitations, and they constructed ways of living to combat their own limitations and to succeed despite their sins and despite their weaknesses.
Mm. And Yale, of all places, you know, last year, coincidentally, I had two top managers from leading news organizations tell me, completely unbeknownst to each other, that they are astonished and disgusted by the extreme self-confidence of the internship applicants who come to interview specifically from Ivy League schools. That this isn't the case from other schools, but that these 21-year-olds really think they know as much about everything as the people hiring them and don't have the humility that a cub reporter or a production assistant is supposed to have, and that the kids from non-Ivy League schools, again, generally do have this humility. Do you think humility at Yale will be a tough topic because of that?
This thought occurred to me, of course, but I would say in general, and not just the Yale students, in general, we've told a generation of people how wonderful they are, and they've believed us. There's a great deal of data showing that levels of narcissism really started kicking up in 1970 and have remained higher and higher in the era of Facebook and reality TV. My favorite statistic that illustrates this was in 1950, the Gallup organization asked high school seniors, are you a very important person? And in 1950, 12% said yes. They asked the same question in 2005, and it wasn't 12% who said yes, it was 80%. And so the number of college students, not only in the Ivy League but elsewhere, who say that they're so important that somebody should write a biography about them is very, very high.
And on that, we leave it with David Brooks, New York Times columnist. Well, maybe I'll talk to you around the next fiscal cliff because it seems like there's always one around the corner. But in the meantime, thanks for your work and thanks for talking about these various things with us.
I will try to cheer up. Thanks.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we will actually return to the fiscal cliff, but also the question of the Sandy relief bill, $60 billion that we thought was going to be coming to New York, New Jersey, and elsewhere. But the House did not vote yesterday. We'll talk to Democratic Congressman Gerald Nadler and Republican Congressman Michael Grimm, both of New York City. Stay with us.